Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can hear us, or you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging parts possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
I am super fantastic. How are you?
Excellent. Glad that you're doing better and continuing to improve from whatever it was that had you down a week or so ago.
Well, it's good to be. I feel like I'm more or less out of it now, and not out of it, but I mean out of the sickness, and back to myself. Last week, I think our show was not. What am I going to say? Logistically, everything it could have been, and I think that might have had something to do with the fact that I was still a little bit sick. I just wanted to kind of check with you on whether I have the story straight here. Now, what did we do? I set the show up at the wrong time, but listed it as the right time on Blog Talk Radio, but the wrong time on the Speculist.
Right.
So people who look for us in one place found the correct time. People who look for us in another place found the wrong time. You and I are
right.
Talking probably 5 minutes before the show's scheduled to begin, and you said, oh, starts on the half hour, right? And I'm like, no, it starts in 5 minutes. At which point we decided we would regularize things and have it start on the half hour when it was supposed to. And I got called away to do something else. I'm like, okay, well, we're not starting for 35 minutes. I come back to the computer about 5 minutes later. The show has started because you weren't able to reschedule. And we've treated the listeners who did find us to complete silence for about 30 minutes.
That's right. We had some dead air. Fortunately, the recorded version of the show, you don't have all that dead air. What you have, basically, is the intro music and then a couple of clicks and then us coming in saying, oh, are we here now? You know, I mean, so fortunately, our delayed listeners don't have to go through all that. But
yeah, actually, I edited out the silence.
Oh, okay, cool.
And
right.
Put it up. That's because we're premium members of Blog Talk Radio.
We have that ability. That's cool.
Yeah, we're able to do those kind of fancy things. So I just want to say to all our loyal listeners who joined last week or who found us later, thank you so much, and we apologize for any confusion or mix-up. Now, we are at a different time tonight as well. We did that in order to accommodate our guests, and we're also thinking that this might be a better time, so we might decide that we'll stay with this time. Oh, I wanted to add, not only did we have all that time confusion, but it wasn't the right night either, was it?
Yeah, it was one day later than normal, again, to accommodate the fact that you were just kind of getting over whatever it was that you were.
Yeah, all told, I maybe should have taken another week off.
It's okay. It's all
what
right.
What the heck? We did our best.
Yeah, it was not a bad show. It's, we got to introduce the Lifesaver bottle. We got to talk about that a little bit. And
how about a quick update on that? How you feeling? How's this pond water treating you?
Well, I'm great. I've been drinking a lot of it, and just kind of continue to experiment on myself, I guess. And I've not been sick. Pond water filtered through the Lifesaver bottle apparently is just as good as bottled water. So, any rate, I find that fascinating.
That's very encouraging. Good to know. Good to know that high technology to one of the oldest high technology solution to one of the oldest low tech problems that plagues humanity is really cool. That works. So,
yep.
I'm going to have to get myself one. I've got a bad case of pond water bottle envy now. So
I'm gonna, That's right.
Can you get them on Amazon? I'll have to take a look.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, well, I'm gonna check that out and get one of those. Well, we've also got Sally Morham, our chat host, on. Sally, how are you?
Hello. I'm great.
Another victim of our scheduling logistical mayhem last week. But actually, you made it on, what, probably 10 minutes into the show, I think.
I think about 20 minutes. I finally figured out, hey, the sound is on, the show is going, and here I am. I mean, and I thought it was early so we could set up. Oops, something got changed here.
Well, very glad you were able to make it, and it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Be extra nice to the folks in the chat room tonight, just because we're hoping to bring them back in to the fold here. Unless they get ornery with you, in which case you do whatever you have to do. So, okay.
All
well,
right.
Our topic this evening is the subject of energy. We're going to talk about energy and the future, and to discuss that with us, we have a special guest, Stephen.
Yes, we have with us tonight Brian Wong. How are you doing, Brian?
I'm doing great.
Excellent.
Brian, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Brian, of course, is the chief blogger over at nextbigfuture.com, and he is the director of research for the Lifeboat Foundation. So Brian, you really are our go-to guy on the subject of energy, I think. When this topic comes up, you're the guy we go to with questions. And just really appreciate the very extensive coverage that you provide of all emerging technologies on Next Big Future. But the attention that you pay to and the detail that you go into on energy is really helpful to people who are trying to sort these issues out and make sense of this.
Well, I very much appreciate your vote of confidence in that. I definitely try and dig into it, just because it's important to understand, because it underpins, the economy and various aspects of the future. If you don't have a good handle on it, then you won't really get a good read on what's happening, what will happen.
Well, how do we dig into this, Stephen? I know you have you're kind of chomping at the bit here because you thought up having this particular topic, and I know there's a bunch of different things you want to get into, but where do you want to start?
Well, I guess I could start by telling you how I got interested in this topic. T. Boone Pickens came to my hometown, I guess it's been almost a year now. It was during the presidential race, he was really pushing the Pickens plan to try to get both the candidates really to pick up and run with this idea that we have to produce more of our energy within our own borders. And the reason, of course, is that if we're sending money overseas, that's to purchase energy, that we end up with a trade imbalance. It's a huge problem for us as a country. His idea was basically more wind and using natural gas, compressed natural gas, as the fuel that we run our cars and our trucks on. And that was basically there's more to it than that, but that's a big part of what the Pickens plan is. And so that's how I got to looking at it. And Brian, in visiting with you in preparation for the show, you pointed to an absolutely fascinating article on energy and national security, written somebody over at the Department of Defense. Is that right, or the Department
Naval
of
Surface Warfare Center? Larry Triola, the guy who wrote that great little article. Not article, it's a paper.
It's huge. He covers energy. just very comprehensively, but he looks at it as a national security issue. If we don't have energy or availability of energy, we can't deploy militarily. And plus, a good way to conquer this nation would be to starve us via energy. If the private sector is not running, nothing else can run either. So that's kind of the point of the paper, and it covers, what do we do? Where do we go from here? So I guess I'll kind of direct the question at you, Brian. What is the situation that we're in at this point, and what do we do about it? I guess we'll start with where are we now? What's going on now with energy?
Okay, well, big picture-wise, you know, there's some stats around that. one is they give, you know, a standard kind of measure for the total energy usage, which they call quadrillion BTU. So the U.S. happens to be around 100 quadrillion BTU, and of that, you know, about 37% is oil. And then next you have coal and natural gas, 20%, like that, nuclear, about 8%. They do some standardization around that in order to get those figures out. Worldwide, we're about 440 some quad BTU. So the actual, you know, breaking out those numbers is somewhat interesting, but just they do some standardization in order to make those numbers kind of comparable, in order to compare solar to and wind to hydro and oil and gas. And then you can also have an understanding unit of tons of oil equivalent as well, because people know that, okay, we have 80-some million barrels of oil produced per day, which kind of works out to, $1.2 trillion gallons of oil, which only half of which is gasoline, because of a 42-gallon barrel, you refine it, and that becomes 20 gallons of oil, and then some diesel, and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of complexity in what's going on there. So that's the overall energy picture. In the U.S., you're using about 20 million barrels per day, 20 million barrels per day, and importing about 12 million barrels per day, maybe down to 11. And then, so that means they're pumping 8 or so of their own. Actually, it's a little less of actual oil and a little more of some synthetic and stuff. And then
What we spend on oil annually, importing oil, is $300 billion, is what I understand. Does that sound about right?
Sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, $300 billion here, $300 billion there, pretty soon you're talking about a lot of money. So,
right.
You know, that's the sort of thing. If,
well, it's 3 years of that, and you got a stimulus package for Christmas.
There you
that's
go.
Right.
There you go.
let's look at the financial issue separately, though. I want to talk about the national security issue because I'm really interested in that. If we get, you said 8 out of 20 barrels domestically, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
That's where we're safe, right? That oil we can count on for sure. And
right.
Then I noticed that our number one importer is actually Canada.
Right.
So that oil is probably not going anywhere, right? After that, it gets a little bit wonky. We used to get a lot of oil from Mexico, and I have observed that that's dropped off precipitously over the last few years.
Yeah, their Cantrell, the big field, has gone down, yeah.
Yeah, so our number one source, I'm guessing, is us. And then number two would be Canada, and then Saudi Arabia, and then there's several others. I mean, we net import more than we export, but the single greatest source is probably the U.S. Is that right? Or
Single source, right. Right.
Yeah.
Single source
yeah.
is the U.S. In terms of energy security issues, us now hasn't been a problem so long as, there's oil exporting nations. And kind of Mexico is kind of like the poster child for more recent peak oil talk, where they're saying, okay, we're going to run out of oil. At least we're going to hit a peak and start going downward slope, where basically the flow rate reaches the maximum and then you're on this downward slope, which the U.S., domestically, kind of had that in the 70s, where basically oil production was going up into the 70s, and then it started going down. There was, a separate move up when Alaska occurred, where oil can go up a little bit, but then it started basically down. That's this Hilbert peak, Hubert, whatever, get the guy named Thurston H. Hilbert, something like that, which is basically the thesis of peak oil. Basically, once you hit that peak, no matter what you do technology-wise, it just keeps going inexorably down. Although, since 2005, it has started to tick back up a little bit in the U.S. I think because of two things, the deep water oil in the Gulf and the Bakken oil field in North Dakota. More impact from the deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico and some impact from the North Dakota, Montana oil,
And is it realistic to imagine us getting a majority of our oil domestically, or all of it domestically? Is that something that could possibly happen, or
could happen if you had a different political situation, where, like California, basically off the shore of California, the Energy Information Administration and geological surveys and stuff say that there's as much oil as Alaska, say, had in that kind of range.
Mm-hmm.
It's sitting offshore of California, which California is saying, because we are the way we are, we don't want to drill that oil. We don't want anyone to drill that oil because we don't want to wreck our coastline. You know, Saudi Arabia can wreck their coastline. Louisiana, Texas can wreck their coastline. Because we're such patriots, we're going to say no. Nobody can go with that oil. And then also the issue of the North Slope of Alaska, whatever that oil is, some oil there. So if you were to say we want that, if you got desperate enough, basically, saying, okay, we want energy, and the only way to get it was oil, and then we're going to wrap this stuff up, we're going to start dumping these holes into the ground and pumping that stuff up, right? You, in theory, probably could do pretty well. The issue is, a lot of people say, is okay, once you start doing stuff, you're not going to get it for 10 years or something like that, right? Well, they've said you can drill there since 1997, which, coincidentally, you know, you probably could have started having quite a bit of oil right now. You know, they have plenty of arguments about that stuff. So there's a lot of politics around that, but if you were to go for all the oil the U.S. has, definitely can do stuff, and then technology-wise, you know, let's talk about technology future, the U.S. has, you know, 260 billion barrels of oil in old oil fields, because you only, especially with the older technology, you can only get about 30-40% of it, because the rest kind of just sticks down there, you know, hanging onto, you know, some hunk of rock, and not coming up, or the water mixes up, and you can't get the proper pressure to get, you know, good clean oil out. So there's a bunch of the drilling technology stuff that if you can enhance your recovery, go from 30% recovery down to 70%, then suddenly the U.S. has another 100 billion barrels of oil, which would be good, you know, using 7 billion barrels a year, you know, another 15 years. There is some technology there, both for getting more natural gas, which and for getting more oil, which could get at that. There's computational models where you could figure out exactly where the oil is in the ground, and then, you know, put your little straw of a pipe down there and suck that out, or you could make it economic to sink a particular well into the ground and say, okay, like normally this well, if I stick it straight down, I'd only get like 20 barrels a day. But if I stick it down, then turn it sideways and then have 50 or 100 holes to suck all along a mile, then instead of sticking 50 or 100 wells down there, each one getting 50 barrels, one well sideways gets all that oil, or get natural gas, either one, the same principle for either one. Or there's ways of, if you have a sludgy oil, based on the thickness of it, you know, some of it's kind of sludgy, the oil sand in Canada, or the oil shale, if you, there's certain techniques like either heating it or creating underground fire and just feeding oxygen into it in a controlled rate, you could then kind of refine it in the ground and turn it from sludge into something liquidy, and then it flows into your pipe. So and that also can get 70%, 80% oil of the oil in the ground, which would, so those things could, I mean, the oil sands work or the oil shale in Colorado, there's plenty of the stuff to get oil, either stuff in old wells or in these deposits which are kind of like not so good. If you get better technology, you get them, and suddenly you're got it all the way you want.
Well, you probably see a more complex energy future for us than just improving our oil gathering technology, though.
Right. Right.
Give us the Brian Wong plan. What does the future of energy look like as far as, I mean, are we going to continue with oil indefinitely, or are there other possibilities that could come forward?
Right. I don't like fossil fuel. We're 85% dependent upon it now in the world, but I would prefer to get off it, mainly not because of climate change. I think, you know, kind of happening. I don't think it's at risk, there's more complex thing going on there. But for sure, I know that 3 million people die every year from air pollution. And then also for coal mining, you got numbers in the 5,000 to 10,000 range every year. So there's a lot of for sure deaths that are happening. And then the 3 million from the World Health Organization figure, I don't think that includes like another 1.5 million from people who burn in third world countries, burn indoor, to light their fires and stuff, some shale or coal or something indoors. Indoor pollution also kills. And basically, these are things that are causing heart disease, cancer, asthma attacks, and things like that, and basically shortening people's lives, 14, 15 years for no good reason. So that's one of the reasons why I don't like fossil fuel. The fact that we're dependent upon it and we can transition out, I feel we could always we can transition out of it. I would bridge and do it in an orderly fashion because, if you went cold turkey, you'd send the place into a wreck and it'd be no good. Because you'd be plenty of fighting, people wouldn't agree to it, it'd be just a bad situation.
Well, one of the reasons I suppose we haven't already transitioned from oil is, for example, a gallon of gasoline, the amount of energy that we can that we get out of a gallon of gasoline, that's hard to beat.
Right.
We don't have batteries that are anywhere near that in terms of weight to the amount of power it can provide.
Yeah, a kilogram of gasoline gives you about 47 megajoules. So that's like loads compared to any kind of
our best batteries. Yeah.
Yeah, 100 times or whatever. Yeah. So in terms of the density of it, it's tough to beat. So you could get this kind of what they call recyclable fuel, where basically you make it yourself from some CO2 source, from something else, and then from biofuels, algae, this other stuff, you produce it, and then it kind of gets burnt up as kind of, you then suck the CO2 out of the air and then make a new set of, another gallon of fuel. So you can produce, use it as more of an energy storage medium, either hydrogen or one of the other fuels, hydrocarbons, and then use that as this dense energy source. To power your vehicles, I would prefer they went to a purely electrical version instead of going that route. I think various physics reasons why I think that works out more efficiently. Plus, you're still sending up that air pollution stuff. Like, because if you mix synthetic fuel, it still has air pollution, which you have to. Yeah.
I was just thinking, what would be the drawbacks of doing something like? Liquefying coal. Surely we can make a liquid fuel out of coal, and I'm sure.
Right, that's an old process that the Germans were using back in World War II to generate the liquid fuel from coal. If you can use something with coal, I prefer that you gasify it. So you can either turn to liquid, which is one process, or you can gasify it with another process. Actually, about 87% of the coal is too deep to get at economically using normal methods. And if you were to, again, stick a pipe down there, send oxygen down and get a controlled burn, you can turn the coal into gas and then, be more like natural gas, which is cleaner. Most of the pollution stayed down when you're burning it, and then you would have natural gas, something more equivalent to natural gas as opposed to an oil-like substance for liquid.
Well, speaking of natural gas, let's look at this a couple of ways. Let's say we want to get to. I think the ultimate end game that we want is everything's electric. That's the world we want to live in.
Right.
And that requires, I think, a level of battery technology that we're moving in on, but we're probably not there yet. To make that economically competitive with liquid fuels, that seems to be the reason we haven't moved to it faster than we.
Unless you can convince people to buy lighter cars or some lighter vehicle, if you give them a souped-up bicycle, which can even go 60, 70 miles per hour, and get some kind of padding shell around it, kind of like those some really light electric vehicles, which are almost like a tricycle, a three-wheel vehicle with a little shell around it, kind of like a teardrop. The name of that vehicle is escaping me this moment.
Is that
but that's the only way.
The smart car? No. The
No. There was Aptera.
Aptera, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So if you went really light, because right now the vehicle weighs, 4,000 pounds to 6,000, 7,000 pounds or more for the bigger vehicles, and the passengers and the stuff they're carrying, maybe only, for one person, most times only one person in the car is, 150 to 300 pounds, right?
Right.
Even with all this stuff, and usually it's not that much. So if you were to get things down where you can safely move at decent speed, then you can really reduce the demands of the ultracapacitor batteries, whatever you're using to generate the electric power. And then there's some work on like nanocrystalline stuff that really ups the electrical engine power and like stuff. And of course, there's all the work is done on the batteries and the ultracapacitors. And then the fact that we're close for a whole car, if you were only moving, say, one quarter of the weight, 1,000 pounds or 500 pounds, and then the person, then you're using far less energy and you're doing far better.
The problem with those models, and I agree, and I'd drive an Aptera if I could get one. I think it'd be kind of cool. But the problem is, you have to ask people to change their behavior, or their view of the world, right? Which is kind of the same problem you have in if you say, hey, we have all this oil offshore in California, right? People would have to view the world differently and do things differently in order to tap into that oil. Now let's say people aren't going to change that much.
Right.
For a moment,
and
they want to drive their great big monstrous SUVs, of which I have one and I like it, but I'd drive an Aptera too. I'm complex. What can I tell you? Okay, so here's the question: to get to where we're running a world that all those people are happy in, that's electric. What's the best route from where we are to there? And I'll ask the question two different ways. One way would be from the money standpoint, okay, from the standpoint of what would be the best way to do that in terms of fixing our own economy and pumping more money back into the economy, and what would be the best way of doing that in terms of taking good care of the planet? Because those two things might not completely overlap. They might overlap, but they might not they might not completely. I mean, is there a scenario where we say, okay, well, yeah, we'll take some coal and we'll use the natural gas we have. We'll have cars running off natural gas for a while, or do we want to have cars running off ethanol for a while? Do we want to bring biofuels into the mix? I mean, what are the intermediate steps and the issues that surround those?
Well, it depends how fast you're trying to do it. Because the thing is, there's 250 million cars in the U.S., maybe pulling in a billion worldwide, and you're only replacing 8% of them a year, right? Like the car sales are, worldwide are 50, 60 million. In the U.S., they were up to 15 million. Now they're back down to like 10 million cars and trucks per year that are being sold. So of the 250 million on the road, you're only replacing 8%. So even if suddenly snap your fingers, every new car is electric, right? It'll still take you 20 years to replace them all if you're just looking at replacing those old vehicles. And if you're only looking at it where everyone still owns their car, I would like to try and figure out a way to, one way to do it fastest would be to give everyone a light vehicle, right? Like China has about 100 million electric bikes. So if you give them a slightly better version of that, say a $1,000 or $2,000 one that can go fairly high speed, and we get foldable where you can have a very small form factor. If you want to say, okay, we're going to make this happen, say this is the eco-friendly road, then instead of giving them a $5,000, $7,000 tax credit to buy a big honking car, at which you're only giving them 20% of the cost, maybe, or 30% of the cost, not even the full cost of the vehicle, right? Then you say, I'm just going to give you here, as many if you want, you know, Amsterdam model of, you know, free electric bikes for everyone, right? Then you can, you know, the whole stimulus thing, you could, if each one only costs $1,000, but if you can drive the cost down by mass production, okay, we get $1,000, then I can make 100 million of those for $100 million, right? And then everyone has one, and then they can use those most of the time. You can say, okay, commute-wide, you got to use this thing. You know, for your free time, you can drive whatever you
want. I'm sorry, Brian, you lost me. How can you make 100 million of those for $100 million? Wouldn't they 100
billion.
Oh, 100 billion. Okay.
100 billion. Gotcha. If you put $1,000, 100 billion. $2,000.
I had you making them at $1 a piece. And I know the volume.
Well, economies of
that
scale.
That was just too good to be true. Yeah. Okay,
so you can have something where basically you just give people this their commuter thing, right? And then it's not really, they're still driving individually, so it's not like you're saying, okay, everyone, you know, the bus transportation Nazis aren't forcing you onto buses, which only 7% of people do, or 5% of people, something like where you are. You're saying, okay, you can still drive a vehicle, but you're just like we, you know, there's odd evens where you can only drive in a vehicle at a certain time. You have zones where, you know, it's all walking, shopping mall, you can't drive in. So there's, you know, like kind of rules where you can say, okay, you know, you just, and why do you have to have so much, you know, quote unquote, fun American experience driving in and to and from work, right? So if you just say, okay, you know, like only when you're off doing, you know, your fun, whatever stuff, are you driving your regular vehicle? So we're not taking it away from you. You can still drive it, you know, for other purposes, but for, you know, so that'd be one way to do it. And also, I think it could be an economic, you know, people are given trillions for stimulus for this and that, you know, like this would be a stimulus. You can, you're stimulating the U.S. Manufacturing of electric, all the components that would be going into the vehicles. So,
well, I'll tell you, if the stimulus had included some stuff like that, I think I would have felt a lot better about it, actually. If I'd have gotten a really cool electric bike out of the deal, you know.
Right.
I don't know. Have they spent it all yet? Maybe they could go ahead with this idea, if anyone's listening. This is a great idea of something with stimulus money. So that would be an interesting intermediate step towards a kind of a there is a people changing their behavior component of that, and getting away from a conventional American idea about how you control your transportation to a new and different idea, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I think you got an uphill climb on introducing something like that. Although I've heard Brad Templeton talk about his idea for you know, flying
robotic cars.
Cars that are shared among people, and there's a great economic case to be made for it. I think that the resistance is going to be tremendous to putting something like that in place.
I also in parallel had, you know, my brother had come up with, you know, some robotic car ideas about the same time that Brad was coming up with his ideas, and I definitely agree that would be a great thing to do. There's some work in England by kind of software company, I think it's called Sentience, something like that, and basically it's a smart cruise control, where basically the cruise control can, instead of just having a set point to say, okay, I'm going 60 miles per hour, it would automatically by GPS, okay, I'm coming up to a light, it's on, it would take you down to zero, and then speed you back up again. So by controlling the speed, you're still controlling the steering, because even though they do have cars that can steer, that's kind of like not quite there yet. You can have you can at least prevent, you can improve the efficiency by about 20%, because you know, people are jackrabbiting off the start burning more fuel and something like that, getting a controlled pace. So that would be, you know, this 20% bump, and then there's some work to get to platooning cars, because there's a quite a bit of your, when you get to highway speeds, you know, a significant fraction of your energy is to fight the wind resistance. But if you could drive close together safely, then all the guys in back are like the Tour de France, they're drafting off the front car or truck. And so they're saving 30-40% on their fuel. So there are larger systems for, okay, we're going to change.
Wow, that's amazing. I never thought about that. So there's this energy advantage to tailgating, really.
Yes, there is.
Absolutely, especially with the big rigs. I've noticed that with my own vehicle.
Yeah.
On the whole safety thing.
It's
dangerous, but you can stretch out a tank of gas that way. Well, I suppose with robotics. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead. I was just going to say, you put that AI in charge and you don't have to worry.
That's right. With robotics, you got it. So
yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, so the latest one on that is that in order to kind of like bootstrap this thing, is that they have the following vehicles. That technology is not too hard. You know, you all have to do just to keep a certain distance and spot that lead, the next car in line. But then they have a lead car driven by your best drivers, right? So,
mm-hmm.
you know, like 10 trucks, 9 are kind of automated to follow, and they can have some intelligence now where they spot something coming in between, they slow up and let that thing pass and then get back in line. And so then the lead car is leading this whole train of vehicles behind it. So that you can accelerate and just deploy onto existing roads and highways this platooning system where, you know, for moving goods, you know, all the stuff to Walmart and to you know, all of the stores, you have your electronic train. So,
well,
you know, transitioning over to the fully robotic system.
You know, I guess our regular trains, our traditional trains, have that advantage already, don't they? Since they're tethered to one another. They're of course all being powered by one engine up front, but you get the advantage that they're drafting each other.
Get the advantage of drafting the transition of energy from the rails to the wheels of the train are more efficient than on a road with a car and that kind of stuff. So there's several advantages that they have. Yeah, more efficient.
Okay. I wonder if we should just replace our roads with a lot of rail and just ride trains.
Of course, the thing is that again takes decades, and then you have to rip everything up. And also there's some stuff where they have dual mode vehicles, where basically you have something that goes on wheels some of the time, but then in the center it has something that could mate up to a single rail line, so that you could then suck energy off that. You know, kind of one of those, kind of like a cable car, or, you know, like that. So that's a dual mode vehicle where you could kind of like compromise. Say, okay, you have a section where you're charging up, and this my middle transformer thing is connecting up to my electrical source and powering me up, and also I don't have to run my engine or do whatever. It's and then I'm charging up, and I leave that, and I can drive wherever. So I'm not limited by where there's not that charging system. But again, that's never taken off. That proposal's been around for a couple of decades, along with the pod car. So the pod car thing is kind of going off in Masdar City in the UAE Dubai area, where they're making a 250,000 person, $15 billion model city in the desert, which we're doing all sorts of interesting technology.
Okay, before we move on to the next topic, I got to give a shout out to Dusty in the chat room. Of course, we want to get to flying cars. Sorry that we don't seem focused in achieving that goal this evening, Dusty. Actually, that is Brad Templeton's goal. Josh Hall's been on the show before and talked about why artificial intelligence driving cars is key to getting us to flying cars. But right now, we got to solve this energy problem before we can have flying cars. So we're going to walk before we can run here. But I think we all know what we're hoping for eventually. The Aptera kind of looks like a flying car. That's one of the reasons I'm kind of.
Well, I also had discussed the flying car thing, where basically you already have UAVs and basically make a UAV for flying cars and stuff. And there's hybrid and electric versions of flying planes and stuff like that. So I think that could be an easier thing than going a fully robotic car thing. Just that whole technically easier, but the problem is, again, people being able to accept the difference. And I think that's the problem, is that only 2% of us are crazy enough to say, I prefer flying car, really.
Yeah, that's the trick. Well, I think there's a lot more of us out there. They haven't stepped up yet. So, Sally, speaking of the chat room, any questions for Brian or topics that have come up that that we'd like to bring to his attention?
Well, I asked my question that I've brought up a couple times before on the show. I have this idea of a really high-tech road. Instead of just pavement, it would be embedded with lots of hardened solar cells, and it would be embedded with guidance for automatic driving for cars, and there would be leads to towns on either side of the road, fueling them with the extra energy that all that solar energy is picking up. Lots of extra computers in there to, well, maybe they could serve as servers for the internet. All kinds of cool stuff in a road, and how much energy, if we could develop things like that, how much energy it could produce and how much energy it could save.
Yeah, there are some people working on various variations of that kind of power-generating road, either through embedded solar cells or from just the vibrational energy of a vehicle passing over it or various other things like that. The problem is you're often looking at, say, ballpark at $1 million, maybe even like $10 million per mile of this super road. And if you're looking to replace 100,000-mile of road, you're quickly getting into insane costs. And then also the whole highway system and road system, you know, we already spend, you know, $300 billion or somewhere like that on on roads and highways and that kind of stuff just in the U.S. And, of course, a lot of that money goes to other things instead of actually building better roads. But, you know, it's taken, you know, like a year, years or multiple years just to widen a section of highway. You know, like I know that my drive is constantly being screwed up because a certain section, like 238, you know, they spent, you know, all this time widening it just one lane. So to actually replace all roads with some kind of smart road would be, you know, you're looking 100 years out maybe before that you finally got anywhere with that. And then you always need to add and build new road. So I prefer to go to any kind of smart or better system with, you know, teeny tiny sensors that you kind of like snick around that guide and tell your vehicles what to do or you know, have some kind of like more of a, the smaller you can make it, the more rapidly you can deploy. You know, like if you can make your iPod super intelligent, but then have it communicate to the computers in your car and do something, you know, that'd be a faster deployment. So you want to go, I think, as light as possible, leverage the electronics and the computers and stuff as much as possible, and build less hard infrastructure if you want to do it faster. The other way, you know, seemed like, okay, that would be the perfect way to go, but then you have to wait then to ramp up your manufacturing capability where, like, we're printing, basically have, say, if you could actually have a vehicle which, you know, is spraying out solar cells onto something and driving at 50 miles per hour, well, okay, then maybe fine. What, convert all your roads to super intelligent roads because you're spraying out solar cells and computer electronics, printable electronics onto the ground behind you. Now we have a deployment system where, yeah, we can then consider that kind of scale. But until you actually get far better manufacturing, going the, if you want something faster, you want to look at as light an infrastructure as possible, which means, you know, more software.
My impression from my ideas, it would absolutely require the development of mature nanotechnology. So it's not something to do next year. Another interesting question was from DDA. He was wondering if we could upgrade our entire transportation system to electric.
I think that is possible. We've already discussed the issues of making that happen. You know, you have to give away electric vehicles. People have trouble accepting and wanting it. There's also people, you know, nostalgic for their, you know, Mustang car or whatever it is. You know, and to get them to give that up is a tough thing because the branding psychology is, you know, they've identified to it. So to get people to change is a very tough thing. You know, I think there's ways to manipulate and adjust that and get that rolled out faster and to get far along that path.
Okay, well, let's move on past transportation for a while, because I think we could easily spend the rest of our time. And Stephen, I know you had some other energy topics that you wanted to ask Brian about. So why don't we move on to some of those?
Well, I wanted to mention at some point in the show space-based solar. In space, obviously, the sun's always shining, and we were able to gather solar power there and then beam it down by microwave. My understanding is that a receiving station that would be a mile in diameter could provide electrical power for 1 million homes. If we were able to deploy that and we could really make a dent in our energy needs that way.
Mm-hmm.
And there
is several companies that are working to demonstrate some fairly large megawatt, multi-megawatt, possibly gigawatt systems. Proposals in Japan. PG&E signed a deal with a small company to say, okay, you know, if you build it, we will buy it. Contract. And they have various ideas about, you know, how to make really light solar cells so that it, you know, can launch less weight, which is, you know, launching costs so expensive, to get more solar up there. So I think that's interesting and could result in something. The problem is the big gap between where we are now and the fact that, you know, like the space station, which costs, you know, many billions of dollars, only has 200 kilowatts of power, but those solar panels are inside the football fields. It's something where you're building big up there and building big on the ground. I'm not as big a fan of that near term. If you get to nanotechnology, then you have J.Stewart Hall thing where you can just float up a bunch of stuff in the upper atmosphere and have it concentrate the light and stuff like that. Or farther down the road, you have the Dyson sphere, Dyson shell type stuff where you're collecting all the power of the sun. I think that faster would be to go to factory mass-produced fission, deep burn, where you're burning up all the uranium or thorium, or to go to fusion. I think there's some various things happening there. I think those probably are stuff that could have more impact sooner than the space-based solar power. If you can make space of it happen, which usually I think would involve finding a way to first get the cost down for launch, and as kind of like using it as a wedge so we can actually start building things in space. You know, I'm not per se against it. If you're just trying to make a good choice for energy, I don't think it's necessarily the best way to go. But near midterm.
Okay. Do you see perhaps a mixed future where we're doing more ground-based solar, we're doing windmills, we're doing, all sorts of things in order to get the electricity we need?
I think barring the breakthroughs, of course, I think the breakthroughs are going to happen, then even without that, there's always the fact that there's different niches for what you're using the power for,
right.
And also people, different groups, like if I have a coal company, I have a windmill company, GE's making windmills, stuff like that, and people want solar power, you know, like for their rooftop or for their, you know, like you had solar powered calculators, stuff like that. So you have all these purposes, you know, you go camping, you want to bring along solar power as a nice, clean energy source, where you would have a mix, a portfolio of technologies. But if you look at it, like right now, solar is still less than 0.1% of U.S. electricity, and winds maybe just cross 1% to 2%, like that. The actual contribution of the mix of a particular section is smaller. My personal prediction on that is that I'm thinking that there will be the breakthroughs in fusion far closer than many people think. And once, in the example of that, the Buzzard fusion or the Focus fusion or General Fusion's kind of like piston version of fusion, and the field reverse configuration of the triathlon energy. So several that look like, I think, could prove out technically feasible, have been intact in 2 to 4 years, and then be deployable before 2020 commercially. And thing is, everything else takes so long to do. Like over the by 2020, maybe you can make 100 regular nuclear reactors worldwide. In the U.S., you'd be lucky to make 10. And then even for all the wind stuff, those big wind farms, you know, you, in order to make a gigawatt of power equivalent to a nuclear power plant, you have to build like 3,000 big 3-megawatt wind turbines. You have to make more wind turbines because of the fact that wind only blows occasionally. So, and these 3,000 wind turbines are, you know, the wings, the span of the spinning blades is like a 747 wings kind of spinning on top of a 60-story spear, right? And it's also probably anchored out in the ocean, which is, you know, on the equivalent of almost an oil platform. So the amount of stuff you have to build, and then that's not even including the factories you had to make to before you can make the stuff, and you also have to send out new cabling to run the power out there because there's no power cable in the ocean. So all of this have to build that way means that, you know, you're even China building as fast as it can would only is only looking at 150 gigawatts by 2020. The U.S. isn't even pushing it as hard. Germany spent, you know, billions and billions making their wind by basically bribing the people who are making it, saying, okay, we'll guarantee you, you know, almost, I think for wind, 10 cents per kilowatt hour and 50 cents per hour for solar. So overpaying for all this stuff, they still only end up with, you know, like 20, 40 gigawatts or whatever the number was. So over 10 years. So the thing is, it takes a crap load of time to make all this stuff. So there is this, so pretty much what you're going to have built by 2020 is either in the planning stages now or under construction now is what you're going to end up with 2020. So we're not going to change hugely by that point using all the old technology. So the breakthrough comes and then boom, you know, you can, if you can factory mass produce it, then, and you can remove the restrictions on building stuff, then you can have this huge change and transformation to that point.
Well
Sorry, go ahead, Stephen.
I imagine a breakthrough like perhaps you know, something I can put on the roof of my house, a solar system that might mm-hmm. cut my power bill by a third, mm-hmm. and it pays for itself in a year. You put something like that on the market. I think that enough people would purchase that it could really change our system pretty quickly.
Well, the problem is you have to make the factory that makes that, right? So the factory takes, you know, 4 years to make one that produces, you know, a few gigawatts per year. So then in order to load them all up in terms of, like, every consumer can have one, it takes, you know, many, many factories to do it. And then the funding for each company, you know, like the biggest company there is, you know, $1 billion, and they, you know, a few $1 billion, they have to, you only fund so many factories, right?
Right.
So that's why, you know, the state-run thing of China can go fast. You can say, okay, we're just going to, you know, the state, which has $2 trillion, is just going to dump a certain few billion here, a few billion here, to push that as fast as possible. The other issue is with solar power and sticking on the rooftop. I'm not particularly a fan of that just because roofing is the sixth most dangerous profession in the country. And so if you were to stick solar cells on 80 million roofs for every residential property, you would probably have a few thousand deaths related to that because of the fact that you're having roofers go up there, and just, you know, the statistics would indicate that's probably what would happen. Although you can, you know, have, if you're stringing them up elsewhere, you can avoid the roofing issue. So that's one. Two is,
I just, before you go further, this is why, yeah, I won't put Christmas lights on my roof. Okay.
Right.
Dangerous.
And the other thing is that there's been some studies, you know, by the various Department of Energy and stuff like that, where like 100 different energy efficient things you can do to your house, and before you go to solar roof, even if it's more efficient, You know, you can get like a tankless water heater. You can add more insulation to your home. There's plenty of things you can do efficiency-wise, which would be have bigger bang for your buck in terms of transforming the energy picture of your home before you need to go to, like, you know, why, you know, for the 11 kilowatts or whatever it is that you the average person, American, has in their home, why go that go have that much solar when you can bring down your the usage down to, say, 3 kilowatts and then stick up your solar panels to get the last little bit. So I think, you know, there's some analysis in there as to what the most efficient route is to, you know, heating the water, to heating your home, cooling your home, that kind of stuff.
Although I will say, having said that, the other side of the coin is that roofing is a temporary thing. Every roof, all those 80 million roofs will be replaced over the
next
20
years.
Yeah,
so if you don't increase your risk by just doing it when the roof is being replaced, you just when it's built and you have it integrated into your roofing shingles, then you're not increasing the risk.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a transition, if it becomes available, we should probably make anyway. Okay, so very little time left. It sounds like the big game changer is going to be fusion, if it shows up. If it doesn't, then it seems like we have some interesting choices to make around what factories are we going to build, what are we going to spend cycles on. We can spend a lot of time building big windmills and then put a lot of resource into that. Or, you know, it seems to me that the math would say that we'd get a lot more bang for our buck if we pursued fission nuclear power, assuming that we could remove the limits on that. But what's
okay? So if fusion doesn't show up, I would say that you want to look at you basically push everywhere, kind of like what China's doing. China actually has an energy transportation plan. So what they're doing is that they're building their fission as fast as possible, as well as building their now trying to build the wind and hydro as fast as possible. They'll have the big Three Gorges Dam every 2 years equivalent, and then try and cutting back on coal. Even though China has up to this point mostly been depending on coal, they are probably going to roll out a new energy plan by the end of the year, which will increase their targets, which have already been increased for nuclear and for hydro and for renewables and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, what you're saying is if there's not a fusion breakthrough, then it's this smorgasbord. Is that right? There's not another big game changer sitting out there. Is that fair to say, or did I assume too much?
Well, there's minor. There's smaller game changers. Like you could, if you had kite generation for wind, you could really reduce how much you know, materials, steel and cement you put into a turbine. So Italy's working on that, where basically you go to higher altitudes with that, with this stronger, steadier wind. So you can do stuff to transform that, and then you also have, to have some storage and that kind of thing. So there's some singles and doubles you can get if you can get the home run. And there's singles and doubles you can get in fission, there's singles and doubles you can get in solar. So you can, and in the recent ARPA-E, $150 million, where they're spreading their bets around 15, 30 different things, wherever it was, of, you know, potential, what they call game changers, would be something which would, you know, provide a substantial boost and shift in each one of the energy, your energy smorgasbord, right? So you can change the shift and make things better. So definitely you want to improve what we call incrementally, but what, you know, it's a big picture incremental, but actually for each one, it'd be fairly transformative. So you can, you just like, in my view, you know, electric cars is somewhat incremental versus fusion, which is the big thing. But for anyone looking at it, no, Prius or Volt or whatever is, you know, at the ground level, fairly transformative. So you can get some fairly big, you know, from the
you can get a lot of bang for a lot of small bucks, it sounds like.
Right, a lot of small bucks.
Yeah,
right.
A lot of different things happening. Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it at that. We've expired our time. Brian, great having you on the show again. Let's have you back on again very soon to explore this further.
Thank you.
All right, Stephen, I know we've got some special music, so tell us about it.
Okay, Halloween-appropriate music. It's the lighter side of H.P. Lovecraft tonight.
Always looking for that.
Yeah, that's right. Tom Smith and Luke Skye are singing Cthulhu Flathagan. So,
all right.
It ought to be
fun. Little visit with the Elder Gods. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and happy Halloween to everyone. Thanks for being part of the program, those listening live in the chat room and those who listen on recording. We will be back next week at the same time on the usual night. So we look forward to being with you all then. And until then, live to see it.
Cthulhu Flathagan.
What a wonderful phrase.
Cthulhu Flathagan. Say it and you're crazy.
It means Cthulhu rising out of the haze.
It's a prophecy we'll all soon see. Cthulhu Flathagan.
Ah, yes, Cthulhu Flathagan. It's our way of life. It's our motto. It's our credo.
Oh, I hate that.
Hate what?
Han Solo clearly shot first.
Not Greedo, credo.
Oh, sorry.
When he was an outer god.
When I was an outer god!
Yay! Dead Cthulhu waits dreaming no longer. He found that his form lacked a certain appeal. All his glistening pseudopods made blood congeal.
I'm a sensitive soul at the end of the day. And it hurts that my friend's flesh all melted away. And all the shame!
Oh, the terrible shame!
What a disgrace!
Falling from grace!
Till I decided to blame!
Whose fault was it?
The whole human race!
Yeah, what were they doing hanging around with an acidic mass of flesh-devouring polyps anyway?
Can I help it if I'm an ick magnet?
Hey.
Cthulhu Flathagan, now we're in for strange days. It screws up your noggin, turns planets into buffets. And great Cthulhu spares whoever obeys. So get off of me, you monstrosity. Cthulhu Flathagan. Cthulhu Flathagan. Cthulhu Flathagan. Cthulhu Flathagan. Cthulhu Flathagan. Cthulhu
Flathagan. Wait. We keep doing this. He's going to show up.
Cool.
It means Cthulhu rising out of the haze.
It's insanity for humanity. Cthulhu Flathagan.
Cthulhu Flathagan.
Cthulhu Flathagan.
Cthulhu Flathagan. I say Cthulhu.
And I say Flathagan.
If I said it backwards.
We need a toboggan. Cthulhu Flathagan. That was a lot of fun. Can we sing another one, please?
Oh, sure thing, my odoriferous pal. Hit it.
Tek-a-lee-lee, 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 tek-a-lee-lee,
tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, submerged in Rilia, Cthulhu sleeps tonight. Come from Rilia, return from Rilia, Cthulhu has a bite. I can't hear you, buddy, back me up. Abhoff?
Yes.
Ow, 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 oh, great Cthulhu, ow, ow, oh, stop. Oh, it hurts.